in Blue Hill, WERU.org, and on our smartphone app, empowering and inspiring community by sharing diverse music, information, and perspectives. Thank you for listening.
Listener support and volunteer power are the foundation of community radio. To donate or volunteer at WERU, please call 469-6600 or email at info@weru.org or pledge online at weru.org. Thank you.
The following program was pre-recorded at an earlier time, and we are not taking phone calls. Thank you.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, the leader of the Oath Keepers, Elmer Stuart Rhodes III, and 10 other individuals were indicted in federal court for seditious conspiracy and other offenses related to the U.S. Capitol breach. And a year after the attempted insurrection, we'll look at some of the crazies who were on the ground, and we'll pull back for a deeper look at the future of the extreme right in American politics. And we'll broadcast our chilling interview with Dan Ellsberg on the dangers of long-range nuclear weapons and the call to ban them. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We broadcast every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. Today in the San Francisco Bay Area, good to have you along with us. And we turn our attention back to Washington. Yes, indeed, as we said, the leader of Oath Keepers, Elmer Stuart Rhodes III, and 10 others were indicted in federal court today. They were arrested. He was arrested. Actually, according to court documents, Rhodes, 56, of Cranberry, Texas, who was the founder and leader of Oath Keeper, was arrested, taken into custody, as well as Edward Vallejo, 63, of Phoenix, Arizona, and they are both being charged for the first time in connection with the events that led up to the attempted insurrection. Joining us to talk about this story is the perfect person, wonderful reporter, Arun Gupta. He has written a series for Raw Story on the insurrection 1 year after. He's a wonderful reporter, has been published widely in mainstream alternative press as well, The Post, Washington Post, The Nation. As I said, this three-part series is in Raw Story. He's written for The Guardian and Jacobin. It is great to have you back, Arun Gupta.
Great to be with you, Dennis.
I'm totally excited because we had you scheduled for yesterday, and I guess some little birdie said maybe you should wait a day. So you've had a chance to pour over it a little bit. Why don't you respond to they took in. They're calling them, I guess they're suggesting these are the two key ringleaders, at least on the ground, Elmer Stuart Rhodes, 56, and the other dude, and Vallejo. Tell us about tell us about Rhodes. Who is he? What's his background? I hear he went to Harvard.
Yale. He's a graduate of Yale Law School, and
he is a
former Army paratrooper. He set up the Oath Keepers about 2009. And this is when you see a surge in both hate groups and militias. And what happened around this time? Well, the first black president is elected, and over the next few years, you saw something like a 400-500% increase in hate groups and militias, the Oath Keepers being one of them. And they take their name because they say, you know, we are upholding our oath to defend the Constitution. So the organization is supposed to be limited to military veterans and current law enforcement officers, which already gives it quite a sinister tinge that you're organizing people who have the training and who are claiming that they are the ones who will best uphold the Constitution. And of course, we don't want people to just take orders, but at the same time, given the history of this country and violent white nationalist militias, we need to be extremely concerned about this. And the Oath Keepers do have a lot of crossover with white nationalism. So this is kind of the biggest drop so far in terms of the 700 people who are being investigated by the Department of Justice in terms of January 6th. And there's been a lot of criticism of the DOJ and Garland. And I think there's something like 71 people have been charged and sentenced so far. And the majority of them have gotten away with no jail time whatsoever. And the criticism has come from even judges on the bench who are pointedly, you know, saying to DOJ prosecutors that you're coming in here saying this is a grave threat to democracy, and then you're asking for home internment or just maybe a few weeks in jail. You know, they caused millions of dollars in damage, and the security bill to basically enhance protection of the Capitol, I believe it was something like $1.5 billion, and they're asking for $500 in restitution. And, you know, you see people who are engaged in kind of the George Floyd protests who are being, you know, sent away for years for standing on the sidewalk. So this is kind of the first big drop. And there's 11 people who are Oath Keepers who are being charged with seditious conspiracy. And if you read the indictment, the heart of it is what is called the manner and means, where the government lays out what they were trying to do and how they tried to effect essentially an armed violent revolt against the U.S. government. And when you read it, it's kind of comical and absurd, but at the same time, it's no joke, because we have to remember, you know, when Trump began his campaign nearly 7 years ago, it also seemed comical and absurd that here's this reality TV host, this racist blowhard, the guy who promoted birtherism, you know, wanting to run for president, and who could think he could ever win the presidency? Well, obviously, we know what happened. And with the Oath Keepers, they are, the government got access to all these encrypted communications. So I think this is also a warning. If you're using Signal, if you're using Proton Mail, anything that's end-to-end encrypted, it's only as good as everyone you're talking to. And they clearly, right, they flip people who were in these message threads because they have a lot of the message. And part of what they're also charging them with is the destruction of documents. So it's essentially a form of obstructing justice, because they say Rhodes and all the others were deleting the messages and evidence of what they were talking about, but the government still has access to all this. So they had assembled two different teams to breach the Capitol, what they called Stack 1 and Stack 2 of Oath Keepers. And they did violently breach the Capitol, attack officers, but they had also assembled these quick reaction forces right outside the Capitol, because you're not, they know a lot of the people who assaulted the Capitol left guns behind because it's illegal to be carrying weapons in D.C. So they had at a motel right over the border had assembled quick reaction forces with an arsenal of weapons that they were going to call on if they needed to assault if they needed assault teams. And when you look at the language leading up to January 6th, on the day itself, after January 6th, they're talking about civil war, guerrilla war, bloodshed. At one point, one of the alleged co-conspirators muses, you know, we need to get boats. You know, the Trump people have all these boats, and we need to get boats that we can ferry, you know, these quick reaction forces and arsenal of weapons across the river, tidal basin, or whatever, into D.C. And the quick reaction forces, there's also a mention that it's all law enforcement. You know, so as we know, this rot goes pretty deep, that there's been a lot of reporting over the years on how much law enforcement agencies have been infiltrated with white supremacists and are sympathetic to white supremacists. And this is very much baked into U.S. history, of course, right? Because the history of policing is that it begins with slave patrols, with suppression of labor organizing, anti-immigrant, you know, the killing of Native Americans. So white nationalism is very much baked into policing, and we continue to see it with January 6th. Not just with all the law enforcement and military veterans who participated in the coup, but the Oath Keepers themselves, who were set up as this kind of quasi-military police arm, and then that they have stationed these teams, allegedly, of police with an arsenal of weapons who are on standby to launch a bloody invasion of the Capitol on or after January 6th.
So according to these charges, it's clear that this action was premeditated, planned, and according to the planners, they were prepared for it to be a lot worse, a lot more deadly. They were planning, they were ready to take it all the way. And there's a lot of information that now supports this. I'm somebody, by the way, who went to, started out his college career in a two-year school in police science. And I learned all about, you know, how to clean up, how to deal with a crime scene and rope it off and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, these guys are setting up around the corner on camps ready with the arms they need if it's going to escalate to the next day. They're giving orders. Never mind, you know, once they started smashing in, it's obvious they need to be arrested once they're smashing in to Congress with the Congress inside trying to carry out a constitutional mandated duty. Why was all this other stuff allowed to happen? Where's the national security state with the ability to bug everyone, everywhere, all the time? We put people in. Yeah, I'm thinking, now I'm picturing Medea Benjamin, the sole 5 foot, what is she, 5 foot six or three? And 15 cops
tiny.
Dragging her out of, you know what, you know what I'm saying here? Whoa. So now they've arrested 700 people that they had to round up. Here we're going up the ladder, but why so long to go up the ladder? And is this where how far they're going to, are they going to take the next step? Because I do remember this dude who was the president of the United States who said, we're going to walk down there now and it's going to get ugly. And then he didn't walk down there and everybody else did. But he did give that's part of the premeditation, isn't it? All this stuff. I'll talk about that. I'm going on, but it's hard to believe that so many people walked away.
Well, so there's two different things I can talk about real quick.
Please.
So one is the warnings. The amount of warnings is just simply extraordinary. DHS knew, this has all been documented, they knew that there was chatter going on Telegram and these other right-wing social media that, you know, we're going to invade the Capitol with armed overwhelming numbers. They knew that they were posting the schematics of the tunnels underneath the Capitol. The FBI warned the day before, there's going to be war at the Capitol. Capitol Hill intelligence, police intelligence, knew that there was going to be white nationalists, violent white nationalists who were coming there. There was one of the post 9/11 phenomena. You know, this is complicated because obviously we need to dismantle the apparatus of the war on terror. And I think in part because what we see that one of the phenomena after 9/11 is the establishment of these fusion centers. And so these are these regional networks. There are 80 of them around the country and also in territories like Guam and Puerto Rico. That bring together federal, state, local law enforcement. And there was a conference call 4 days before January 6th. And the official who, the security official who initiated the conference call, African-American, and I think this is telling, he said he expected, you know, maybe a couple dozen people would get on the call. And he's like, within minutes, there's 300 security officials from virtually every one of these 80 fusion centers, right? So you're talking hundreds and hundreds of law enforcement agencies. No, and they are just, he's asked for tips. And this is, there's a big Washington Post report on it people should look at. An avalanche of warnings, specific, credible, just this massive avalanche of warnings. And then meanwhile, it's just like there's virtually no police response. And I think, you know, the simple-minded explanation is going to be a conspiracy. But of course, there's no one who has this power over all these government agencies, because police, law enforcement agencies are very jealous of their turf. They don't like to cooperate. So there's no way you're going to get anyone who's going to be able to make every single one of them stand down. What it is really is the mindset. And as someone myself who, you know, reports a lot on civil liberties. I'm on the board of two different civil liberties outfits. I do a lot on, you know, policing, police brutality, and all that. It's the mentality, right? The mentality that exists, that they could not perceive that this was a threat. And you compare it to what happened just 7 months earlier in Washington, D.C., with the peaceful Black Lives Matter protest, where you see this, essentially, this military response, you know, to the point that they're actually using battlefield tactics, where they use those helicopters coming down on protesters to use the just the fierce wash that generates, like, basically hurricane force winds, that they had Humvees, that whole incident where National Guard is firing weapons and tear gas and clearing the streets so Trump can have his photo op of walking to the church and brandishing the Bible. You know, you compare that, and that's because Black people are seen as a threat and have always been seen as a threat in this country, and white nationalists are seen as good, upstanding Americans. Now, one of the things that really jumps out to me, again, because I study this, is in the indictment, the Oath Keepers at one point are screaming at the Capitol police officer, "We'll leave out the expletives," that this is our effing building, you know, and get out of here, and they're screaming at it, "This is our building." And that is the essence of white supremacy, right? That these are our institutions, that white people can decide to use violence. They have the right to use this righteous violence to take over our institutions. And of course, as we know, a lot of the police officers were African American, you know, and they're using the N-word, they're waving, bringing in Confederate flags, they have nooses, but it is this idea of literal ownership of the institutions, and they can deploy whatever violence, and it's just. Meanwhile, if Black people wanted protests and use civil disobedience, we need to use military force against them.
We're speaking with Arun Gupta, and he has a wonderful three-part series you want to check out in Raw Story. Since the insurrection, a year since the insurrection, a three-part series important to look at because the mainstream has dropped the ball in many ways. I'm not surprised, and neither are you, I'm sure. So how does it jump from Oath Keepers? You know, this is the first, you know, these are serious charges, seditious conspiracy. Some of these charges got 20 years possible prison sentence. But how does it jump from there? Because we all heard Trump say, we are going to march down there. And then we saw his other crew and Giuliani, and it was all sort of, you know, we're going to go get him. And we don't think Pence is going to do the right thing. So, I mean, they didn't say it, but clearly they had the gallows.
They were in the standing
Mike Pence.
Well, you know,
right.
you see, and I think, you know, what's of course, this isn't like, you know, a West Wing fantasy where, you know, people find their convictions and courage through a dramatic speech. I mean, we have, what it is just the raw exercise of power to the point that Mike Pence, who was nearly the victim of a lynching, is now downplaying that day because his whole existence depends on appealing to this white nationalist lynch mob. But I think if you look at the indictment, they've laid out, you know, evidence that stretches back to right after the election in 2020, where the Oath Keepers are already talking about, you know, we're taking reconnaissance trips to Washington, D.C. for an upcoming operation that they're organizing military-style basic training for militias, that they're holding trainings on unconventional warfares for new recruits. Stuart Rhodes is laying out tens of thousands of dollars before and after January 6th on munitions, on weapons, on all sorts of accessories, scopes, mounts, night vision goggles. They're renting these rooms. They're creating. They have three or four different quick reaction forces from various states that they're organizing over months before January 6th. And so, you know, a lot of this was obviously known, and there was a complete failure to act. You know, now the problem is this virus, this violence has become a pandemic in the Republican Party. The next coup is not going to look like the last one. I think we may very well see invasions of state capitals again. I mean, that's another point, actually, right? We saw all these precursors to it. There were invasions of state capitals in Idaho, Michigan, and Oregon. And, you know, a lot of this, I'm actually writing a six-part series for Raw Story. I've got three more articles on the way, and one of them I talk about is how Portland, that none of this would have happened without Portland. And, you know, just a week or two before January 6th, the state capital in Salem is invaded by a violent right-wing militia that they were let in by a state legislature. This is one of the unanswered questions of January 6th, still, right? You know, how much were representatives, this kind of like, you know, fascist contingent that is within the House, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Matt Gaetz, Lauren Boebert, Madison Cawthorn, you know, Gosard, Gomar, how much were they actively collaborating? I think Ali Alexander, the guy who is the head of Stop the Steal, is he's claiming that his side was in direct communications with various representatives. But now this virus has completely infected the Republican Party. You have 40% of the base, according to a recent poll, believe the use of violence for political ends is legitimate. And again, we don't want to have terrorism laws, but that is actually the very definition of terrorism, using violence to influence public opinion in terms of politics, you know, especially for political ends. So you have the base of the Republican Party is now, you know, endorsing terrorism. You have these congressional members, right? You know, you have like, who was it? I think it was Boebert who was basically calling Ilhan Omar a terrorist, saying that she was mistaken as a terrorist by the Capitol Hill police. You have Gosar who tweeted that anime video of a cartoon of him killing AOC. You know, so this is very much the core of the Republican Party, and you have all these laws now, right, that have passed, something like 39 laws in 14 states that are going to aid the Republicans in stealing the election, and you have these absurd Democrats like Sinema and Manchin, and I think they're actually the fall people, because if you look at what they're actually saying, there was a good piece in the Daily Poster a few months ago, that's David Serrata's project, where he shows exactly what Manchin is saying about the filibuster is taken almost word from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, right? Because they're the ones. It's the ruling class. And, you know, who is Joe Manchin? He's a coal baron. He's worth $12 million. He owns a yacht. He drives a Maserati. His daughter
The imagery there is almost overwhelming. I'm sure you saw the scene about the with the canoes, and he's taking questions from his yacht.
There's
way down there, the people. Go on.
It's a failure of Biden to use his power ruthlessly, and not that. This is not by any means an endorsement of Trump or who Trump was, who Andrew Cuomo was, who they are as people, but they knew how to use power. Andrew Cuomo would absolutely destroy anyone who dared cross him, and he would make it clear he would destroy them. Biden has this massive power. He could have made it clear the instant, even before he was in office, he sent surrogates, and you just start to ratchet up the pressure. You fall in line, or things are going to happen to you. Things are going to happen to your family and friends. Things are going to happen to your associates. You start holding up all the funding for the states that you can. You use whatever mechanism. Suddenly the federal taps start to dry to your state. Suddenly your state starts to be flooded with EPA inspectors, with IRS and Treasury agents, with agricultural inspectors, with OSHA inspectors. You use that power ruthlessly, because this is a fight for the basic survival of people. And, you know, just say one kind of thing that's linked to this, because this is where we're headed. 2 years ago, I was down at the border reporting on the refugee camps. There have never been refugee camps in the history of the United States until Donald Trump. And Biden has made them bipartisan. And those refugee camps, which hold tens of thousands of migrants in desperate, dangerous conditions, are the seeds of death camps. In 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, those will become death camps. That is where we're headed.
Haiti already is a death camp based on U.S. policy. Come on. We're locking people down in flights and pushing them back into the burning fire. You know, what's going on in terms of, I've been on that beat, that immigration beat for a long time, but I've never seen anything close to the violence the United States is perpetrating.
17,200 patients. 17,200 people have been deported back to Haiti. This is illegal and criminal. We are denying them their right to asylum. And when we want to talk about fascism, these asylum laws are a direct result of World War II and the fact that we were turning away ships full of Jews who were trying to escape Nazi Europe and sent them back to Europe, where most of them died in death camps. That's why we have these conventions on the rights of refugees, on the right of asylum, and the Biden administration is illegally, criminally denying them this, right? So we have to understand fascism is a bipartisan project. And so what we're seeing is much more complicated than the headline of armed oath keepers. Certainly that's kind of the leading edge of it. It's a very dangerous element in the tip of the spear when you have these lunatics with their quick reaction forces and their arsenal of weapons, who are ready to, like, basically go on boat and invade the capital, hand-to-hand combat. They're talking about civil war, guerrilla war, you know, death and bloodshed. Yeah, but that is very much just the tip of the iceberg of a much more both complicated and simple story about how the Republicans are affecting another coup, and that how we are really on the cusp of a very dark time if we don't do something about it, and people need to get up their butts and quit complaining and do something about it.
I can concur with that. We're going to have to leave it there, but only for now. We want to follow you. When you get those other stories done, we are definitely interested in speaking to you about your reporting, the work you're doing at Raw Story right now. You've got three pieces, I guess, they're already done and up.
Mm-hmm.
And you say you're working on a couple more?
Three more pieces. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
We're going to keep an eye on that.
In
the aftermath.
Well, we hope that you will come back, and maybe next time we can open, we'll have some time to open the phones, because I know the listeners to this show would love to grill you on a whole bunch of stuff. So we'll leave it there for now, but thank you very much for joining us today, Arun Gupta. It is always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Dennis, for all the great work you've done over the years.
Okay, be safe. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short musical break. When we come back, we are going to replay our terrifying interview with Daniel Ellsberg about the need to take these massive nuclear weapons on, ready to trigger at a drop of the hat, trigger on, launch ready, whatever the hell the term is. It's horrifying. We'll take a break. We'll be back with Daniel Ellsberg. Also honored to have joining us Dan Ellsberg, probably the most significant whistleblower in the 20th and the 21st century. I'm not going to guess what's going to happen in the 22nd century, but Dan Ellsberg, welcome back to Flashpoints. It's good to have you
glad
with us.
Glad to be here.
Terrific. Well, it's good to have you. Now, tell us about these missiles. What are they, and why are they on hair trigger?
Okay, the missiles are in concrete silos, and supposedly to protect them from enemy attack, involved in Soviet Union, now Russia, conceivably China, ICBM attack. Unfortunately, half a century ago, missiles became accurate enough to destroy other missiles in a silo. You know, they're close enough. They can reach close enough. So the missiles that we have in these silos, which are rehearsed every day, there are people in those underground silos who get, at no notice warning, signals the time has come, you know, to launch your missiles, and they practice it several times a day, turning the keys, doing all this. It will end most civilized life if actually the day the warning is that there actually are missiles on the way. And that warning is often false. We get warnings like that all the time. Some of them are very serious. And fortunately, the inaccuracy of the warning has been discovered within a minute or two of the president giving an order of 10 minutes in order to launch those missiles, which, if launched, will be part of a war that will cause a nuclear winter and kill most people on Earth. So, in other words, it's obscene, it's absurd, it's ridiculous to think of having a system that will destroy civilization on a 10-minute alert, and to think of a person, one president, or in Russia, Putin, or in others who have their fingers on it, others being confronted with the notion, if you don't launch those missiles, Mr. President, we will lose that $1 trillion investment. Our missiles will be destroyed in their silos, so you've got to launch them. And as I say, they actually rehearse this doomsday machine effect every day. It's absurd. It's expensive, but that's $250 billion are going to be spent on a new set of missiles, which should not exist. The existing missiles should not have existed for more than half a century, even from a Cold Warrior point of view. It's been nothing but the Air Force retaining that mission away from the Navy with their submarine missiles, which are invulnerable, unlike these. So these missiles, these vulnerable launch-on-warning missiles, should have been discarded at least half a century ago. They keep going for basically one reason only. Well, the Air Force wants them. They don't want to give up that mission. But the thing that sells it to Congress is it's a big jobs program. And that's a euphemism. It's a profits program for Boeing, for Northrop Grumman, for Raytheon, for General Dynamics. At the moment, Northrop Grumman has the sole contract, the sole bidder for the contract on the new ICBM. But their subcontractor is Lockheed, and they have Boeing tried to get in on it, rejected for some reason. They have arranged to have subcontracts in most districts in the country, and virtually in almost every state in the country. So every senator, every congressperson is confronted with, we can't get rid of those missiles, or making new missiles, new Minuteman missiles, one, two, three, because, the assembly line would close and people would be out of work. Now, almost any other use of that money would make for more jobs than spending it on weapons, which are high-tech, high investment jobs. If you spent that same amount of money on, which is tens of millions, billions, but say just a billion or two, take away from that program, put it on education or health or infrastructure, it'd create many more jobs, but for the same amount of money. But these are jobs Republicans will budget for. Not for health, not for infrastructure, as we're seeing. We can't afford that, but any amount of money for so-called national security. And it has nothing to do with national security. It is a pork program. It's legislative pork.
Well, actually, it has everything to do with national insecurity, Dan. I'm sure you would agree. Let me tell people, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are honored to be joined by legendary whistleblower Dan Ellsberg. We're talking about declaration made today public. More than 60 national and regional organizations issued a joint statement calling for the elimination of these 400 land-based nuclear missiles we're talking about now with Dan Ellsberg. You know, Dan, we shared a mutual friend in the late Paul Berman. And Paul, before he saw the light, if you will, his job, he was working for Henry Kissinger. And as a mathematician, Paul's job was to say, the impact of these kinds of weapons we're talking about, at 20 miles, 40 miles, 60 miles, whatever. And he would talk about it in the most terrified way, but tell us something. What would one missile do if it was launched and it landed in Moscow, central Moscow? Well, what would that mean to the people of Moscow?
Most of the missiles now are smaller than they used to be because we put the number of them on one missile. MIRs, they call it, multiple independently retargetable vehicles. And so to get several of them on one missile, they're smaller than they used to be. But it so happens, I just read today, that one of the things that they may get rid of is the B-63 bomb, which is the last megaton bomb. Now, that's a million tons of dynamite, of high explosive equivalent. Remember, in World War II, the biggest, what they call blockbusters, because they destroyed a city block, were 10, 15, there were a few 20-ton bombs that would destroy a city block. And some of them, by the way, are still buried. They keep finding them in Germany. They have an explosion. They have to take thousands of people out of the area so they can dig up this bomb and try to destroy it peacefully. Instead of, well, these ICBMs are like those very bombs in the silos. They can go off with a false alarm any time. But your question was now the yield issue. And as I say, those were, say, 15 tons, kind of typical for a blockbuster. The Hiroshima bomb was what we call an atomic bomb and fission bomb. For me, we are studying of heavy elements, U-235, or plutonium. And at Hiroshima, that was between, they figure it differently, 13 kilotons to maybe 16 kilotons. That's 13 or 15,000 tons, not 15 tons, but it's 1,000 times more. The fission bombs are now necessary as triggers to the thermonuclear bombs, the fusion bombs, which ultimately fuse light element, higher isotopes of hydrogen. And those are 1,000 times more than the Hiroshima bomb or the Nagasaki bomb. So it's the first droppable bomb that we dealt with in 1954 was 15 megatons, 15 million tons, as opposed to 15 tons. So it's a million times more than the blockbusters of World War II. That's 15 megatons. And we had weapons that were like 24 megatons. Now, most of those have been relieved, have been dismantled now, because you get more, sorry to say it, but bang for the buck, you get more killing if you distribute a number of smaller bombs over an area than having one big bomb which wastes a lot of its destructive power upwards into the sky and so forth. So most of them are smaller, but this one, this debating literally today, I saw this in Defense News, the one thing that Biden may actually get rid of. Why? Because Obama was going to get rid of the B-63. I think that's the designation for it. He had it designated to get rid of it. But Trump, of course, retrieved it. Well, yeah, we need megaton bombs. And you asked what a megaton would do. A megaton in a city area, a metropolitan city area, would destroy everything within miles of it. Could easily cause 100,000 or more casualties, depending on the density of the city and so forth. You can get, let's say, with a large 10 megaton or 5 megaton that we used to have a lot of, you could get a million casualties killed, not just the casualties from the larger burning area and so forth. In other words, a million people is half an Auschwitz, actually. About 2 million people were killed at Auschwitz. So, in other words, one warhead would kill, let's say two warheads, would be an Auschwitz. These things were an Auschwitz, a portable Auschwitz is what they are. And we have thousands of them. When Eisenhower left office, there was something, let's see, when he came into office, I think there were about 1,400 warheads. When he left office, it was 22,000 warheads. Some of them were. When Johnson left office, and I worked for Kennedy and Johnson and a little bit for Nixon, when they left office, we had something like 37,000, I think it was. The total for the world with the Russians was about 69,000, something like that, warheads. And we're talking now, tens of thousands of those were multi-megaton thermonuclear weapons. So there aren't that many cities in the world, obviously. Herb York, the first director of Livermore Labs, in charge of the site, doing a lot of H-bomb thermonuclear research, later head of research and engineering in the Defense Department, later a major arms negotiator. He asked at his old laboratory, Livermore, once, he reflected on the question, how many warheads does it take to deter an enemy rational enough to be deterred? And he said, I could ask people about that. He said, in my mind, I think it's like one, or maybe 10. Think, for example, of how much deterrence Saddam would have had if he'd had 10 thermonuclear, even 10 atomic weapons, and so forth. He said, okay, let's go from another point of view. What is the maximum number of deaths that one man should be able to bring about in a short period of time? Well, there's no simple answer to that, But let's just say, suppose it were World War II, 60 million deaths over 6 years. So, well, that would take about 100 warheads, 100 helicopter warheads. It may be more than that, but not much more than that. So I said, it seems to me that the appropriate number to deter nuclear attacks, we're talking national security now, against a nuclear opponent, is between 1 and 10 or 100, and closer to 1 than 100. We have reduced our stockpiles after the Cold War by 80%, and we still have, or agreed to have, 1,550, not 100, not 10, not 50, 1,500 weapons on alert. Now half of them at sea, half of them, a little less than half, vulnerable in the Minuteman silos. And the Russians, about the same. We're both supposed to have 1,500. They have a little bit more. This has no relation to national security or to deterrence of attack. It is a military-industrial complex plugging along, getting campaign donations, satisfying service desires to be in the game, competition between the Air Force and the Navy. The Army is out of this particular competition. And as they say, campaign donations, jobs, they really are jobs. And get rid of them? You can't. We're calling, we have 60 groups now, some sergeants, positions for social responsibility and others, calling for the elimination of these weapons. Is that going to happen? No, we don't come to Congress with bags of money like the hundreds and hundreds of lobbyists from these corporations do. We just say it's wrong to be preparing to end most human life, not all of it, most human life at a moment's notice. That shouldn't, we shouldn't be doing that. And but we are, because it pays.
Well, we're speaking with Dan Ellsberg. We're talking about a declaration today. 60 national regional organizations issued a statement calling for the elimination of these warheads. We're talking about some 400 land-based nuclear missiles now armed and on hair trigger alert. What is hair trigger? What exactly does hair trigger mean?
It means that all of those weapons, man and missiles, with solid fuel, can be fired at a moment's notice, are to be able to be launched within actually a couple of minutes in terms of the missiles. The reason you talk about 10 minutes, it doesn't take that long to get these missiles off the ground when they get a warning, which may or may not be a correct warning. It may be a false warning. The 10 minutes is the amount of time the president would have after they have detected the missile, after the enemy missile, after it's launched and gone up in various ways, infrared satellites when they launch the plume of the missile, then in the stratosphere, the upper regions, and then coming down, the radars, the various things. Is this really a missile attack, they have to ask? Well, actually, nowadays, people are always putting up weather satellites, or different kinds of satellites with missiles, setting up missiles for various kinds of tricks, countries. So they get a lot of, on their warning system, they get a lot of warnings, but they filter out a lot of these, and they're coming. How many are coming? Where are they coming from? Where are they coming to? It takes about 20 minutes to decide whether there's actually an attack on. If there is an attack, it lands in 30 minutes. So, I'm a little rough on the calculations here, but the 30 minutes is a pretty good figure for that for the Soviet Union or Russia now to come at us, or China. So, part of that time is taken, and the president has maybe several minutes, or as much as 10, to decide, get those Minuteman missiles off. He doesn't have to decide about the sub-launch missiles, 700 warheads at sea on patrol, enough to cause nuclear winter in themselves. So that's a doomsday machine. And then the Minuteman or another doomsday machine, meaning killing most people on Earth. So we've got two of them. At least. And we have bombers who could do it too. So he has no great pressure on him to do anything about the subs because they can last months, a year under there is nothing left. The Minutemen, however, he's about to lose. And one could ask, so what? What good is it to put them off if we're under attack? I don't think anyone has asked that question in the White House or the Pentagon ever. And I was working on war plans 60 years ago on this, and certainly that was unthinkable. It wasn't just unsayable. It's unimaginable. Why fire these weapons if they're at us? You know, their missiles are already on the way. We can't destroy them. It will just add to the... well, we didn't know about nuclear winter then. But in 1983... that's 40 years ago now, they realized that the smoke from the cities we would hit, whether or not they were admitting they were destroying cities, but they were hitting command and control targets in the cities and air bases next to the cities and air defenses and this and that. Hundreds and hundreds of cities would burn in firestorms, unusual storms, as at Hiroshima, where the smoke would be lofted into the stratosphere where it wouldn't rain out. It would go around the world within days and cut off about 70% of the sunlight, enough to kill all harvests. And depending on the season of the year, it will even in spring and the summer, freeze lakes, freeze rivers and so forth. But the main thing is it would kill all food production. And our stores of food production in the world, a lot of them in the U.S., are worth about 60 days. Well, we wouldn't be exporting a lot at that point. And by the way, we would have lost our cities pretty much. But anyway, within a year, nearly everyone would be dead. Not everyone, because the scientists who work on this, like Brian Toon, Alan Roebuck, who done these calculations, say, no, probably between 1 and 10% of the people would survive. People in Australia, on the shores, in New Zealand, like Peter Thiel, who bought up a lot of land in New Zealand for this purpose, would survive on fish and mollusks and whatever food they stored. And, you know, 1% is a lot of people. It's 78 million people. That's quite a bit there in historic terms. But 98% gone. Or say it was 90% are gone. So you have, what is it, 700 million. Well, almost 800 million. Is there, I might have the message go on here, but it's like that. The rest gone. And that is the risk we are taking, you could say, hour by hour, day by day, but above all, in a crisis. And we're heading toward crises with China over Taiwan, possible armed conflict with Chinese for the first time since Korea, conflict with Russian troops over Ukraine, talking about today and yesterday. NATO was talking about prepared for a large conventional conflict, a non-nuclear conflict, which would be a stalemate and which would challenge one side or the other to go nuclear weapons and then to escalate. This is insane talk, and it's taking place at the highest levels in the U.S. and Russia and Taiwan and other places. This is as insane as believing that Trump is the president. And that seems to be believed by about 70% of Republicans. So we're caught here in an insane situation. And we should change it. It isn't going to change because preparing for the war is what we do. $780 billion in a defense budget. And preparing for it is very profitable. And it's going to
well, this is the
like
thing,
fun.
Dan. This is what really worries me. Now, there is a corporate side to this, isn't there? We certainly have one of the driving forces is the war makers and the profit motive. How powerful are they in keeping this steamroller towards nuclear insanity going?
Well, the very powerful, more than you or me, or the people we talk to, or the people who listen to this program. Actually, there used to be a movement, the Freeze movement, back in the early 1980s, inspired by Ronald Reagan's loose talk about winning World War III, scared people. And they said, let's stop, you know, on both sides. Freeze. But no, that didn't get anywhere. The Russians, by the way, accepted that idea, proposed it, said, let's do it. But Reagan, no. So he had promised to increase our defense budget. Right now, Biden said he would take care of inflation by increasing the defense budget. He campaigned on this by about 1%. But Congress has just, as you know, added $25 billion to a $730 billion or so budget with no idea of, there's hardly anyone in Congress who knows even what I've said so far. They don't know what they're voting on. They just know money goes to us. We're not spending it. We're not buying French planes. We're buying American planes. As a matter of fact, I just saw today again in defense, they issued calling on the Germans have a what's called tornado plane, which they're going to replace. And today they started thinking, maybe we'll buy F-35s, a $1.5 trillion program,
which is
total 100% pork. A plane that will probably, you know, is outclassed by other planes in almost any one of its functions. And we're talking now about putting nuclear weapons on F-35s or Germany, and if they use those weapons, no Germans would be left, or Europeans or Russians. So, you know, it wouldn't be a matter of anything invidious here. Putting F-35s around the world with nuclear weapons on them, as if you're going to use them in combat, do they really believe that? I don't know. What they do know is that it's worth life. That's a Lockheed thing. Lockheed is a subcontractor on the ICBMs. Boeing dropped out of bidding. So we have this $250 billion program for 30 years. $100 billion in the next 10 years. Going to one bidder. It's a little unusual. And why? Because Boeing noticed that Northrop Grumman had just bought a solid fuel company that makes the fuel for the missiles. And in theory, they're supposed to be able to sell it, you know, to any aircraft company that wants it on the same basis. But Boeing suspected that Northrop Grumman would get a better deal out of this from the company they had just acquired. So they dropped out. These are the kind of, in other words, they are bidding on doomsday machines. And this is not bidding on Zyklon B for 6 million people in Auschwitz and other places in Germany. We're not talking about 6 million people. We're talking about 6 billion people. What can a human mind do to comprehend the idea of planning to bring about the death of 6-7 billion people?
I tell you, it's sort of like a pandemic in a split second. We're out of time, Dan, but I would love to give you 30 seconds for a shout out to Julian Assange.
Well,
so people remember.
Listen, I have to say, you introduced me as, you know, whistleblower of the 21st century. No, I was in the last century. I did release some top secret stuff this year about Taiwan to no effect that I can keep. But this morning, I got a call from Marion, Illinois, Supermax prison, with Daniel Hale, who I would say along with Ed Snowden and Chelsea Manning and Julian Assange, these are the whistleblowers of the 21st century. Why is Daniel Hale in a Supermax prison wrapped by COVID, enormous COVID, for having revealed that we kill many, many, many more people who are not targeted in our drone program, our assassination program? We kill 17 untargeted people for every targeted person we assassinate. So for that, he's in a Supermax prison. I'm going to talk to him tomorrow and ask him how the COVID thing is going. But these people are heroes of mine. They are the greatest patriots we have, and they're patriots not only of this country, of humanity.
And Dad, please tell Daniel Hale to put Flashpoints and Dennis Bernstein on his call list, because I wanna open that dialogue. We understand
that,
he's
would
a
be
hero
great,
along
but you
with.
Know, I just looked up what is Supermax prisons for. To learn.
Oh, that's right. They stop them from talking to journalists.
Talking,
yeah, right.
From talking to journalists, they can't do it. It was a 5-minute call.
Oh God. What am I thinking, Dan? What am I thinking? Anyway, we're going to leave it there. But as always, Daniel Ellsberg, you have done extraordinary work to enlighten all of us. The battle obviously continues. And I didn't purposely ask you about the atomic clock because I know the terrible answer. It's not looking good. We're out of here for now. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.